Thank you. I'm going to ask Professor Richard Yanda to lead his group to the front. Hey, Richard. While our panelists are coming to the... While our panelists are settling in, let me very quickly introduce the moderator of the panel, Professor Richard Yanda, who is an associate professor at the McGill Faculty of Law and an associate member of the McGill School of the Environment. And Richard, I'm just going to turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Chris. It's an honor to be here to engage in what I think is going to be an interesting and important part of this discussion about ownership, who owns our oil. I should announce to begin with that one of our four panelists, Ariel Deranger, is sadly unable to be with us today, but we will make up for that. Okay. We will make up for that with a little bit more time for our own panelists, and I hope also a little bit more time for discussion. Before I make a few introductory remarks of my own, I'll simply give a very brief introduction to our panelists. I think you have more information about their biographies in your materials, but we have a distinguished group with us. We'll be led off by Scott Vaughan, who has a long record of public service, but is currently president and CEO of the International Institute for Sustainable Development. He'll be followed by Catherine Kustachin, who is a lawyer. She's an Aboriginal person herself, and she has been specializing in environmental and natural resource law. And finally, Ken Chapman will give us his observations. He's the former chair of Oil Sands Developers Group and executive director of Northern Initiatives. So I think we'll have an opportunity to gather together Aboriginal perspectives, environmental perspectives, and industry perspectives. To launch our discussion, I thought I might recount a parable as we consider the question of who owns our oil. Imagine the following story. In the beginning, when the world was made, God saw that life was good and let it multiply upon the face of the earth. But she bound life to death because the finite earth could not support life's infinite expansion. However, as a gift from death to life, she allowed to be stored in the residue of past life energy that could serve future life. This gift from past life came, nevertheless, with a burden and a curse. For to release all of the energy of dead life would kill the possibility of future life. The burden for present life was thus to learn when and how to stop drawing on the energy of past life so as not to kill future life. The curse was that present life would become so addicted to this energy that it would be unable to prevent itself from turning it into a lethal poison. One form taken by this addiction was to allow ownership of the residue of past life. Through ownership, according to my parable, all hope of self-restraint was lost because the addicted owner could only get his fix by releasing the energy left in that residue. The owner addict received no pleasure from leaving the residue in the earth. And so ends my parable. according to which the question as to who owns our oil might be answered as follows. Those who own our oil are those most addicted to releasing energy, the unbounded use of which will destroy the possibility of future life. I thought I'd launch a little bit of a provocative introduction. With that, I'll turn it over to Scott Vaughan.
Thank you very much. Let me also congratulate and thank the McGill Institute. I think it's a really important topic, and I'm looking forward to the discussions. I wanted to touch on three things under this rubric of who owns our oil. So one is some direct issues related to ownership. And then secondly, who buys our oil? I was asked to talk a little about international markets. We heard about it from Annette and others in the first panel. And then the third one is to go back to this issue of climate change. So what are some of the implications of oil consumption? So on the first one, on ownership. So I'm sure everyone in this room knows under the Canadian Constitution, the provinces narrowly hold jurisdiction over natural resource use and then by extension ownership. And however, federal government has important responsibilities. In my old job as a federal commissioner, I looked and my colleagues looked at how the federal government was doing on its responsibilities related to what this government has called responsible resource development. And what we said was not so great. We reported to Parliament fairly consistently that, and I think as Annette made the point, there's no scarcity of regulations, but there was still a chronic problem within Canada on inspection, enforcement, and follow-up. And Lac Megantic is one tragic example of that. We presented a report to Parliament 2 years ago on transport of dangerous goods in the rail sector, and you needed to bolster inspections. And many of the issues in pipelines, similarly, oil spill capacity response, and increasingly vulnerable areas like the Arctic, these are becoming now, you know, increasingly serious issues. So we tend to look at this issue in terms of ownership within a provincial-federal lens, but I think what I wanted to just talk a little bit about, and I'm very much looking forward to Catherine's comments, which is the last question from the previous panel, which is Aboriginal First Nations. So just to say on this, that there's been now 180 court cases for which First Nations in Canada have won. And that is related to an expectation that Aboriginal peoples, First Nations, have some clear rights and expectations related to natural resources. And those can be divided very broadly into two areas. So one is fiduciary rights, traditional use of hunting, fishing, but also expectation that the land upon which their traditional rights have been exercised is protected. So that's the first one. And then the second one is an expectation that natural resource development shall not cause harm to Aboriginal communities. And there's been a number of Supreme Court decisions on this, and I think one of the issues that I've been told in my previous job, and I'm sure everyone here has heard it as well, the expectation around duty to consult, both at the federal level and at the provincial level, that we probably know from a common sense perspective what that means. I've been told by many, many Aboriginal leaders, including George Erasmus, that often that duty to consult means somebody going in with a checklist, going through a list, walking away, and having no idea whether they heard some of the views, the concerns, and expectations of Aboriginal peoples, as well as what the response would be. So I think this duty to consult is an important issue, but I think the second one, more important, is this expectation of accommodation. And there's been numerous Supreme Court decisions which have provided interpretation of this. I think one which is interesting is the 2005 Haida Supreme Court decision. I'll just read very briefly, which is on how the court framed this, is that the honor of the crowned is that, quote, interpreting treaties and documents generously, negotiating and where appropriate, consulting with and accommodating Aboriginal interests, and justifying legislative objectives when Aboriginal rights are infringed. So there's an absolutely clear legal now pattern on this, and this is where I think it's now we're beginning to see some, you know, significant changes on where we traditionally think about it is between provincial and federal. And I think there's three areas which are useful to think about it. And one is from a recent book by Bill Gallagher called Resource Rulers, and he's been a lawyer who has consistently lost in courts trying to defend natural resource interests. And I think he finally woke up and wrote a book and he thought, you know what, the rules have changed because of court proceedings and court precedents. And essentially now First Nations hold a veto power, is how he has argued. They hold a veto power under major natural resource extraction projects. And this, I think, is extremely important when we think about next steps in Northern Gateway. The second is issue about extending, I think, from doing no harm and avoiding harm in resource extraction projects to looking at new models of benefit and benefit sharing. And this, I think, is really, really interesting. My colleagues at ISD have been working on this internationally in South Africa, in Brazil, in India, and elsewhere. And it's really twofold. So one is to say, make sure for foreign investors coming in, that make sure what you know what you're signing before you sign, because you can often end up where foreign investors have priority rights over water, and other areas before local communities. And then secondly is look at linkages within these investments which create backwards and forward linkages which benefit communities. And there's examples of this now which I think will grow. And then the third one is just from a conservation perspective. I think it'd be fair to say that now the most interesting, exciting, innovative, hopeful areas for conservation in Canada are ones in which Aboriginal peoples are actually partners. And if you compare that to conservation internationals in Canada that have tried to move without Aboriginal peoples, the returns have been minuscule and disappointing. And, you know, we could talk about a few. One was related to Canadian boreal forestry. So that's my first area. The second one is who buys our oil. This is more complicated, and I'm not quite sure why the panel asked me to do this. But just to say very briefly, in terms of total production, oil sands has now surpassed conventional oils, about 1.7 million barrels a day compared to 1.3 million. In terms of that total production, it's about 70%. It goes from 65 to 73 in 2013, according to the National Energy Board. It goes for export markets, and the largest majority of that export market is the United States by a huge margin, over 90%. Why I say it's complicated is because some of that oil is then refined and then re-imported into Canada from the United States. Some comes from the United States and goes up to refineries in St. John's and New Brunswick. And so getting actually this delineation is complicated, which is why I'm looking forward to IDB's work and the databases on this. The other part of this is the issue around royalties. And again, we talked about fiscal policy reform this morning, and also if you're going to hinge on a $2 a barrel. One of the questions is royalties. And again, if you wanted to find an area which is about as opaque as it gets in terms of public policy, trying to identify actual royalty rates that foreign or Canadian companies pay is incredibly complicated. But I think the rule of thumb is anywhere between 6% to 10% per barrel, if you wanted to look at it a percentage term. If you then wanted to say the impact of this, and this is from a political economy perspective, where do those royalties go? They go back to who owns it, that goes to the provinces, provincial budgets. So if you look at it from the federal side, trying to understand the contribution of these royalties to the federal budget, and again, Ed is absolutely right, it's incredibly complicated. If you look at it to the provinces, British Columbia, about 10% of their revenues are from the oil and gas sector. Alberta, it's about 20%. Newfoundland is close to 30% now. And that raises question then that if you think of one single a group that actually has a powerful contribution to national revenues and provincial revenues, it's in the energy sector. And that then raises questions about where we are in Canada in terms of probably who has the largest voice as a lobby group within, certainly Ottawa, it would be the petroleum sector without any question. The other question I just want to raise, and then I'll end with climate, is why it's also so difficult to calculate royalty rates is because of Canada's fiscal policy work. So the federal government, according to a report that we did last year, and this was based on Finance Canada's own work, federal government will spend about $800 million a year on subsidies to the fossil fuel sector. That's a lot of money. If you compare that to what they spend on trying to bring down mitigation, if they spend it on terms of trying to grease pumps in terms of accelerating innovation and new technologies, $800 million, they're going in the right direction on some of the fiscal policy measures. The accelerated capital cost allowance depreciation rate has actually come down. Some of the fiscal benefits in the oil sands have come down. But nevertheless, that's federal, and then if you add up provincial, it gets to, you know, probably doubling or more. And then you step back and you say, what does it look like worldwide? And the International Monetary Fund, which is among the best monetary economists in the world, their estimate now is that worldwide total fossil fuel subsidies are $1.9 trillion. So if you wanted to look at one, you know, conceivable, you know, bang for the buck in terms of actually trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, my colleagues in something called the Global Subsidies Initiative have been trying to put on the table what these numbers look like. And so the last thing I'll end is just with the climate change issue. And this is, I absolutely agree, is that these issues become immediately wedged. And the only thing, what we sort of strongly work towards is looking at what the scientific evidence says. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is going to be coming out with their second report under the fifth assessment, and that's going to be this spring. And what that says is, one, there's no scientific debate whatsoever anymore about climate change. That's absolutely well behind us. And then the question is, what do we have to do to keep below a 2 degrees Celsius temperature increase? And to get there, when you look globally at the expansion of per capita consumption with demographic increases in population growth, we have to find a way of meeting within a carbon budget which brings down total greenhouse gas emissions by 60%. So it's by 60%. If you think about, you know, how much struggle we've been in Kyoto, which has actually had, you know, an insignificant dent on what the challenges are, we have to find a way of actually bringing down greenhouse gas emissions to get to two degrees Celsius, which in itself is catastrophic enough. And I think what most scientists are now looking at is not 2 degrees, it's 4 degrees to 6 degrees, and this is absolutely science fiction catastrophic. It's not fear-mongering. It's what the future, and the future is now, and this is hugely impactful, and particularly on Aboriginal peoples that depend on lands in outside of built-up urban environments. So I'll end with a note of hope, and that is we talked a little about having to scale up renewable energy. Where I think things are actually moving right now is, one, the corporations are now starting to book climate risk, and Exxon being one. They're doing this voluntarily, but they know that something is coming because they know the carbon budgets are now coming. But then secondly, we've worked on climate projects and environmental projects only within project finance. And if you look at global project finance, it's about $300 billion a year. If you look at where most money is in the world, it's in capital markets. Those are essentially bond markets. And in January, a group of the largest banks, including JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, HSBC, there was unfortunately no Canadian banks on that list, released a thing called the Green Bond Principles, which are now to set some criteria to try to open up those international capital markets to put some real weight behind the transition to a low-carbon economy. And I think that's where there's some hope to actually say, can we make that transition? So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Bonjour. So my name is Catherine, and I'm originally from Attawapiskat First Nation, and I'm a lawyer, and I'm based out of Toronto. First of all, I'd like to thank the McGill Institute for inviting me to speak here today, and I would also like to acknowledge the Mohawk peoples, because we're talking about such a big topic that also impacts a lot of Aboriginal communities, and I'd like to acknowledge that we're here today, because this is their traditional territory, and that's what I'm going to be talking about. So I was asked by McGill to speak about the Aboriginal legal duty to consult, just to give a summary of what it is all about and the common realities and actually the practical realities of how it's applied in the Canadian context. So that's my overview, and I'll be providing a few examples. So the Aboriginal legal duty to consult, of course, it stems from Section 35 of the Constitution Act, and it recognizes and affirms Aboriginal and treaty rights. And as my friend here mentioned, it's rooted in the principle of the honor of the crown. And what is the honor of the crown? Well, it is the government's duty to consult and accommodate Aboriginal interests under the guise of honor of the crown. The Honor of the Crown recognizes the Crown's unique historical and fiduciary relationship with Aboriginal peoples of Canada. And essentially what it means is that the Crown, which I mean government, is supposed to act honorably in its dealings with Aboriginal peoples. So however, although Aboriginal peoples have rights, they're not absolute. The Crown can actually infringe Aboriginal rights on as long as they have justifiable reasons, and this is rooted in Supreme Court cases as well. Essentially, it is a hierarchical way of how to manage competing interests, such as Aboriginal interests may be infringed upon in the pursuit of public interests, such as pursuing economic interests. So that's a justifiable way of looking at how to balance these competing interests, according to government. So when is Aboriginal consultation triggered? So the Crown always retains the duty to consult. So when it has to make decisions that may impact Aboriginal treaty rights, such as in the case of a mining context, for example, the mining company, in order to open a mine, will want approval from the Crown, so it needs a permit, and then it will have to go through a series of environmental assessment processes. So, but the Crown, because it owes that duty, like fiduciary obligation with Aboriginal peoples, it must get the proponent to consult with the First Nations. And then what we mean by when we say, well, the Crown may delegate procedure aspects to proponents, that really means is that industry has to do the legwork and doing the consultation for the Crown, and they'll develop the engagement plan, the terms of reference on what it's supposed to be consulting on. So when it develops its environmental assessment report to the Crown, the government will assess its adequacy and it will decide whether to give the project a thumbs up. That's the way normally it goes. So the intensity, so people always ask, well, how much should we be engaged in the consultation process? It's really depending on the scope of the project and how that project will impact those Aboriginal asserted treaty rights and or other rights. So let's take for example, just giving just examples here. So there's a road widening over a highway. That may be a little project, but depending on if there's asserted or Aboriginal treaty rights in the area, that will depend on the level of consultation. So for instance, where there's a road widening and maybe there's a burial site in the area, so that would require a more higher level of consultation because burial rights are really considered high Aboriginal rights. So there's a more those impacts would have to be mitigated, so the industry or the proponent engaged in a project would have to, let's say, divert the road widening to somewhere else. And if that couldn't happen, some type of accommodation agreement would be negotiated with the community that's impacted. And other things that we look at as well, such as mines or opening of hydro dams, those are major projects, so most likely there would be intensive consultation in those areas. So it's a spectrum. It's hard to see this. So I mentioned briefly, so when there's impacts, they can be mitigated. So you conduct an EA, there's certain impacts that can actually be accommodated. Most of the time, industries does a good, well, not always, but it does try to mitigate some of those impacts. And when there's when they cannot mitigate those impacts, they'll accommodate. And that's when they'll negotiate compensatory agreements, such as impact benefit agreements, participation agreements. And just for example, as you had the previous speakers here, Sunova said that they talked about they have some agreements first with a couple of First Nations. And most likely, that's what occurred. They're drilling in their traditional territory. Some impacts were addressed by, well, and accommodated through this compensation agreement. And other aspects are also partnership agreements. This is another step ahead where proponents actually partner with an Aboriginal community, and whereas the Aboriginal community will become the proponent themselves in the project. So there are some arrangements that are made between energy companies, such as in Northern Ontario, OPG formed an agreement with Moose Cree First Nation, and they became equity partners with several other First Nations to run the upgrade the Lower Mattagami River Hydro Project. So those are examples. Oh, and also I was told I should discuss what impact benefit agreements really are and what type of arrangements. So in retrospect, really, it's really about giving jobs and business opportunities to the communities. And most impact arrangements I see, it's really giving the Aboriginal community to be involved in the project, but not necessarily always involved in decision-making. So the practical reality. I want to correct my friend here. I don't know. Maybe Canadian law, Aboriginal peoples do not have a veto, and that's the cases. Bill Gallagher, I know, Natural Resources book, you know, it's a positive overview of what First Nations have done to get, you know, assert their Aboriginal treaty rights. But in practical reality, they do not have veto. If they did, I would say that they would probably be more included in the mainstream decision-making of all these projects. And they're not. Because you see a lot of the litigation has come away with a lot of these major projects, such as Northern Gateway. If they did have veto, I mean, I think they would have been more involved in those decision-making aspects of those projects. And where Aboriginal people are suing Free Prior Informed Consent, FPIC, an acronym. It's recognized by the United Declaration of Indigenous Rights. And really, let me just go back. Because FPIC is endorsed by First Nations, or when I say First Nation, Aboriginal peoples, FPIC, because FPIC probably broadly refers to the rights of Indigenous peoples to participate in decision-making affecting their lands and resources. It requires commitment from the state to obtain free and prior informed consent of Indigenous peoples before any projects occur. And consent itself gives the Indigenous group the option of supporting or rejecting development that has significant impacts on their Aboriginal lands and culture. So, and when you look at the federal policy on Aboriginal consultation, they really do not recognize that Aboriginal peoples have consent or veto power. They only can engage in a level of consultation and to mitigate those impacts through negotiating agreements. And just to talk about a few examples, the Northern Gateway Pipeline. So, as you know, probably some of you are aware, the joint review panel led by the National Energy Board recommended to Canada to approve the project with over like 209 conditions. So the project consists of constructing and operating a 1,172-kilometer pipeline from Alberta's oil sand to the coastal Kitimat, and that's where you see the previous picture here before, so that's where the pipeline will end or be picked up by ships to be transported to Asia. And much of the project actually crosses through Aboriginal lands and where they're, well, Aboriginal peoples continue to occupy and use these lands. So really, the process of the judicial the joint review panel, Canada relies on this process because to them it's fulfilling the consultation requirement. Where really the panel process does not consider the scope or adequacy of consultation. It's just a process. And it does not, it may not be the most appropriate way to conduct consultation itself, because the panel process is adversarial. Issues raised are limited by the scope of the terms of reference of the EA review, environmental assessment review. So how does that address the adequacy of consultation? And it does not lend itself to working out solutions in partnership with the communities, between government and industry. And this is why First Nations in the area are gearing up for legal battle. And it's likely to become a test case for what level of consultation with Aboriginal peoples is required. And it will be very interesting in that respect. Another point about the whole panel process that struck me was the Crown said that it put $400,000 for 31 Aboriginal communities to take part in the panel process, and that's not enough. In my experience, when you're going through an EA process, you need a lot of money, like just for one or two communities to be engaged in such a process. You need at least 400 grand would cover three communities at least. So that's not adequate. Because for all these communities are limited in capacity, they don't have the resources, they need experts that can help them make the independent reviews for all the environmental analysis reports that they're expected to review and comment. And another project that brings close to where I'm from originally, the Ring of Fire. Just to give you a bit of background, essentially there are 21 companies that hold claims in the area. It's about 5,000 kilometers, square kilometers, where potential, the major proponent right now is Norwont, but previously it was also Cliffs Resources. And just to give you a background, Cliffs and Norwont submitted their proposals to conduct the EAs for these projects. But because of the political climate and judicial review applications that the First Nations in this area launched, it raised considerable issues in the whole implementation of the project itself for Cliffs. And since then, they have pulled out. Not because, I would say, of the First Nations consultation aspect, it was more of a government issue about money and infrastructure and how they're going to expand and develop in the Northern Ontario region. And currently, there are negotiations between Mattawa First Nations, which is, there are a number of First Nations that are going to be impacted by the Ring of Fire project, and notably Mattawa Council, who's spearheading the negotiations with the Ontario government. They hired the former Premier Bob Rae to be their lead negotiator, and the province of Ontario has hired former Supreme Court Judge Frank Yagabuchi. But there'll be issues raised in this matter as well, because Mattawa First Nations, they're only a limited chunk of First Nations that are actually being involved, like being accommodated. There's also going to be a whole slew of other First Nations that are going to be impacted, and notably I have to say it's going to be my community, because De Beers is there, they have the Diamond Project, and there's more projects to be occurring, so they need to do a cumulative impact study or a regional study, and there's no such plan put in place at this time. So commonalities between such projects such as the Ring of Fire, even though Ring of Fire is mining itself for minerals, a lot of the natural resources issues are commonly, they vary between Aboriginal issues. Aboriginal peoples, they experience the same things. There's competing perspectives on what is Aboriginal consultation. Aboriginal communities demand to be treated fairly and equally and participate in decision-making processes. But what these review panels are doing, a lot of it comes from also just a justification test in Sparrow, economic interests override conservation and Aboriginal interests. But, you know, we try to be hopeful, reconciliation moving forward. I was reading Douglas Eifert's report to the Prime Minister. He was hired by government to identify the approaches that could meet Canada's goals for expanding energy markets and increasing Aboriginal participation in the West. And he made some really good recommendations, I thought. It will be up to the government whether they want to take him up on his recommendations. And one of them is that, you know, Canada needs to focus on building its relationship outside of the consultation process with Aboriginal peoples beyond projects. And that whole stems with the whole, it's government recognizing of their unique relationship with Aboriginal peoples to be, for First Nations to be treated on government-to-government or nation-to-nation level. And it's identifying redresses for the land claims and also discussing revenue sharing. And to end as well, other things that they could be considering is implementation of FPIC principles, where Aboriginal communities can have meaningful input on projects on when they occur, where all parties share information to allow for learning and consensus building in decision making. And another simple consideration, I think, is more regional planning and to address cumulative impact assessment of projects. Because such projects such as the Northern Gateway and the Ring of Fire, they involve considerable collective collaboration. Overall, for most Aboriginal communities, it's not about owning a resource per se, but it's about looking after Mother Earth. It's being stewards of the land and having a say on addressing those impacts that may affect generations to come. And that's what I'll say. Mingwech.
Immensely talking to them on the phone and meeting them in person for the first time, but I think this is a very vital part of this whole conference that, although the title has got a misnomer in it, who owns our oil, I think it's self-evident in the title, it's the our part of it that's confusing. I want to deal with the issue of petrocultures from the culture side. There's been a lot talked about the legalities and responsibilities and rights on the legal side, but I think that we've got a situation here. There was an interesting part of the panel this morning on the economic side. We have regional petrocultures. I come from Alberta, and I live in a petroculture, and I have aspirations for that petroculture that are significant. I have cynicism and great criticisms about it at the same time, but I hold great hope for the opportunity to do it right there. There was a question earlier about other jurisdictions and how this works around the world. If we can't get it right in Alberta and Canada, given all the blessings and the stability and the providence of resource and a stable government, a rule of law, a volatile but reliable currency, and so on, a healthy society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where else is this going to happen? And I think that we have to be exemplars and aspire to be exemplars in that way for the planet. Not just the people on it, but for the planet. So the issue of ownership. The Natural Resources Transfer Act tells me, as a citizen of Alberta, I'm an owner. The treaty with the Treaty 8 people legitimately say that they have an equitable ownership in this. And I think that's real, but hardly yet a reality. And we're working on it. The Aboriginal aspects here have been ignored and abused, not just in Alberta, but across this country for a century and a half in my area, longer in other places, 400 years since settlement. And now it's just emerging. I have a lot of hope when I see Idle No More happening, which is taking on the government of Canada, but also taking on the governments in their own jurisdictions and asking for more transparency and accountability in these areas. The other thing about the issue of Aboriginal ownership is that it's not ever going to be recognized and acknowledged sufficiently until the federal governments and the provincial governments take on the responsibility for fulfilling a treaty right as opposed to delegating an adversarial process in a regulatory model to an industry to negotiate these things. These are international sovereign agreements. These are not trading off interests between opponents in some kind of a court case. The companies can't do this. They're not equipped to do this. And when they do their best, they are not even coming close to meeting the obligations and spirit and intent of the treaties. I think that if we do anything out of this, I think we should start teaching Canadians Treaty 101 and putting it on our governments. That's not going to happen unless we as citizens insist on it. And the companies cannot be held to have their feet put to the fire on these things. And, quite frankly, the Aboriginal governments should not be having to go and deal with these things on a bunch of one-offs basis at the expense that they have to go through, and they don't have the expertise. So it becomes even more adversarial. They become medieval morality plays as opposed to effective consultation. So I'm very, very concerned, but hold great hopes that we can get this thing right eventually. And the other thing about it from the company side, I'm talking oil sands only because that's pretty much all I know, is that when we do these benefit agreements, we make them confidential. We make them proprietary. We hide them from the public. Companies take the attitude, and I think legitimately so, that they're proprietary in a part because it gives them competitive advantage in the marketplace. But those costs of that come right off royalties, my royalties as a citizen. I want transparency in that from the companies, and I'm sure people in First Nations want transparency from their own governments as to where those monies are coming from and what they're what they're designated for and how it's being spent. There's lots of blame to go around both ways on this ownership issue. And then there's the issue of the ownership of the companies, again talking oil sands. There's an awful lot of foreign ownership in the oil sands. Talking to Sapporo earlier, just at a break, their studies show that about 72% of oil sands companies have foreign ownership. Some people can say that's a terrible thing. I think that's an amazingly positive opportunity. If we can have influence on those other companies, on the things that we're talking about in terms of responsible and sustainable resource development, and take on climate change, only even though that we're decimal dust in the great calculation, if we took it under the moral authority that we assume that we're going to fix that because we can and because we should, we may be able to set examples for those other organizations. And I'm delighted that we have this kind of interest coming into the oil sands from around the world. And it's not just for the investment interest. Quite frankly, they're buying hedge funds. We're just a big hedge fund for them in the terms of economics. But the reality is, when you look at the cultural elements, we could do much more than that and could be so much more than that. So I'm encouraged by that. The other thing in the ownership, I don't think we're ever going to see it, a court case that will be allowed where we'll see whether or not the Natural Resource Transfer Act is superior to the treaties. That's the big elephant in the room. Who would win that? I think everybody's afraid to ask the question except philosophically, but not legally, because the consequences could be dire for both sides. And so we have mutual agreement not to go there by the consequences of the answer. So we will not get there. But the other side of it is, the oil sands companies do not, and any of these energy companies, in any of the regulated natural resource interests, do not own the resource. It's owned by the citizens of the country or the citizens of the province. And as a result of that, and picking up on the Cenovus' statistics and the studies that they've been doing, is that the citizenry in this country is ignorant to the level of naivety that it's dangerous. Is that they presume smart people are going to handle this? Well, we're not electing smart people. Okay. We're electing people who are interested in power and influence. Ceases must be here. Enough said. We're not electing smart people. The government are merely our property managers as citizens, and our regulators should be more independent and arm's length on this and be more comprehensive. We're now finally, after how many years, looking at cumulative environmental impacts of resource development. When are we going to start looking at cumulative social impacts of resource development? Those are pretty significant things. And I want to talk to you a little bit now in close on why, on the ownership of the oil sands, I feel like an owner, but more of a trustee. I think Catherine is an owner, more than an equitable owner, but she's also a trustee. I can learn so much from her and her people in how to do this better if we could just get in the room and have a conversation, a real, authentic conversation that was open and interested in it. On the reclamation responsibilities that are inherent in the oil sands, we cannot do that in any optimal way without the traditional knowledge and wisdom of the Aboriginal communities. And I think the last generation that has that is now dying off. And unless that is transferred to the future generations, by the time we get not serious about reclamation, but it picks up pace, we're going to need that because we have to develop sustainable biospheres. We won't put it back to exactly what it was. That's not possible. But we can put it back to something that is sustainable, diverse, and unique in the country. The other thing about ownership and responsibilities of this ownership that I'm very optimistic about and is that the long-term positive impacts out of oil sands will be technology and innovation. This is Alberta's moonshot. We are 4 million people in a country of 35 to 37. People argue that a bit. They argue the 4 million too, but enough said on it. My point being we're a small country, widely dispersed, with lots of complexity, but a value set that is tied to the land. Even at this, for sure in the Aboriginal side, but even at the settler side. And as we've urbanized, we've lost that. And now we see natural resources as an economic opportunity, an environmental responsibility, and just because you got a job, you must be happy. In the social side. And the social side really comes out of this remediation. As we as a society take a look at reclamation, remediation, and restoration, and did that with a vengeance and with the right value set, that's the long-term positive export coming to the oil sands. Look at that in terms of a kind of gift to the planet coming into the oil sands. If we learn how to do that so well that we could take on war sites, natural disaster areas, other industrial sites around the world that need this for the sake of the planet and turn green jobs and new technologies and export that along with our education system, and the oil sands could be a catalyst for that because it's drawing people around the world that want to start doing that. We're ready for that next phase. And that's where we're at. So as an owner, I'm proud of being an Albertan. I'm not so proud of being an owner of the oil sands. I'm getting there, though, and I'm optimistic. I used to be cynical, now I'm aspirational, and I'm starting to evolve into optimistic because I see some really good things happen. But there's fundamental change that has to happen at the institutional level and at the relationship level. And that's where we're going. The conversation has started. The two extremes are boring. They're not having any impact. They're not moving the needle. And the 60% of Canadians in the middle who don't know who to believe and trust are uncertain. As long as they're uncertain, we can work with that. As soon as they become indifferent, the whole game is over. Thank you.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists for fascinating presentations. Before I turn it to the mics and invite you for your questions and comments, you know, it occurred to me listening to the three of you that if we had you in the room, the three of you, we could probably make significant constructive progress on many of these questions. And I thought I'd just tackle what seems to be a small one, but an interesting one that arose, which is impact and benefit agreements and Ken's suggestion that there was an issue about confidentiality around these agreements. Same issue has arisen in Quebec, of course, and what we've discovered is that sometimes it's also the Aboriginal communities that want confidentiality because they're concerned that whatever is in those agreements might be held against them as they're dealing with the federal government and whatever the federal government is going to be, you know, transferring in its relationships with Aboriginal people. So I just wondered, I mean, I agree with what was being said. I just wondered if the panelists had a comment on that specific issue.
I think that's a legitimate fear because of clawbacks. If you're getting this kind of money from industry, why are we giving you these kinds of monies in other ways, and I think that we as citizens should not allow that to happen. It's not, we're spending, people say we're spending an awful lot of money on Aboriginal relations, and maybe we are, but we're sure not spending it effectively. And I think that clawback provision is something citizens have to stand up and say, this isn't going to get them ahead. And the second thing about the confidentiality is that where I think Aboriginal people have a legitimate concern over confidentiality is if these agreements are too detailed about certain sites that are sacred sites and traditional knowledge sites. They don't want a bunch of white tourists walking around, you know, being do-gooders about this. I think there's some reason to keep those sites confidential. But the financial terms, forget it. They've got to be public.
Catherine, do you have a comment on that?
I understand that some of the issues regarding confidentiality are really lawyers who are drafting these agreements can actually be creative in the sense that you can limit certain areas to be confidential or not, and that's why there's no standing rule that everything has to be confidential. So it's really working with the industry and community what can be kept confidential, but I understand the public accountability issue as well. So it's really, however, they'll be moving forward in the future. But I know with my community, being part of the financial auditing that happened, the third party, they had nothing to hide in a sense. It was confirmed. But I think in the future they've learned that when the future negotiations, they'll be more out there when it comes to negotiating the agreements.
Just very briefly, in the institute where I am now, we have, I think, 12 or 15 lawyers, and they're working on IBA agreements every day around the world. And they come up with these great stories, and I say, you should tell the world about this. And I said, we can't. It's confidential. It's essentially doing pro bono work behind closed doors. Where I do think things are moving is north of 60. I think in Nunavut and elsewhere, they're actually becoming more transparent, and particularly, and also in Northwest Territories with devolution. And there's really, really interesting governance now with the land and water management boards. And so some of this, we're getting at least now a picture of some more stylized components of what those IBA agreements look like. But I take your point. We have a long way to go to make them more in the public domain.
Well, let me invite questions from the audience.
Hey, that's actually the perfect lead-in to my question, because I wanted to ask about North of 60, where obviously there's a lot. Oh, my name is Shirley. I'm at Concordia. And my question is, obviously north of 60, there's a lot of potential resource development, and these areas are mostly governed by modern land claim agreements, which have slightly different provisions. And there's two really interesting tests that I see right now that I'd welcome some thoughts on. So one has already been mentioned, which is basically the federal government has put forward in consultation with NWT some devolution legislation, which amalgamated and changed the structures of the water boards that First Nations had negotiated in their final land claims agreement without them being consulted. So that's a very interesting thing about what are Aboriginal rights going forward. And the other one that I'm really curious about is the Peel case. So last week, Nyacho Nyack Dunn and Trondikwichin First Nation, in association with CPAWS and YCS, took the Yukon government to court about these issues of consultation. And I'm just wondering what the implications of those cases are for opening up or closing down what consultation means in the future for natural resource industries in the North.
Okay, thank you. Quick responses to that?
I don't know the Peel case.
No, I don't know the case, but I do know. I mean, I agree with your point on that this is moving really, really quickly. And you mentioned the November 2013 report, the Prime Minister commissioned. There was another report that came out of Neil McCrank, for those of you that are following this, and he reported in 2010. And similarly, I think it was very insightful, and it addressed some of the issues that you raised, because right now, particularly with devolution in Northwest Territories, there's a lot of questions about outstanding liability, who's going to own it as that transition moves forward, but also then with these really big precedent-setting land settlement agreements, and, you know, started with Nellie Cornway and Nunavik and then moving elsewhere. I may be naive and optimistic on this, but I actually think that the law of the land is being written right now as we're sitting here. And what this will look like 10 years from now is going to break out of, I think, what, you know, Ken has, I think, correctly characterized, that this has been a really absolutely abysmally poor story now that's gone on for centuries. And you can see it just on living conditions on reserves within Canada. I mean, it's the conditions have gotten worse, not better, in the last 10 years on almost every single indicator we take for granted. So we desperately need a new governance. And I think watching the North will be where there's real grounds for optimism.
Great. Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm an environmental science at McGill, and also I'm part of Divest McGill, who has quite a few members here today. So thank you all for your insights. And Scott in particular was saying there's no debate that we're responsible for climate change and that we know that to keep warming under 2 degrees Celsius, we're going to have a global carbon budget where about 60 to 80% of existing fossil fuel reserves are kept underground just to maintain basically a livable planet for all of us. So my question is, given this imperative and the fact that the tar sands alone hold enough carbon to almost fill that carbon budget, how can we move away from debating whether or not we should shift to low-carbon energy sources and discussing how we can power a positive and necessary shift towards a low-carbon future?
A great question. Who wants to start in on it?
Can I?
Please.
I consider Fort McMurray my second home. Carbon is a big deal coming out of the oil sands. Oil sands, tar sands, I don't care what you call it one way. It's tomato, tomato to me, and 98% of Canadians don't make the distinctions either. It's just people seem to want to get upset about it for some strange reason. The issue of climate change is, and where Canada's role in it, is our overwhelmingly it's transportation and our as-built environment. So if we're going to make a difference in climate change, you have to start personally in this room right now and look at where you live, how you live, and how you move around. And you start making those decisions, the market will respond to you. But if you don't make those decisions, the market's not going to respond to you. And we're caught in a market model as opposed to an environmental collaborative model. And until that changes, and I think until that changes, we're not going to do it without regulation, without legislation. And that's not going to happen unless you, again, ask for it. But give me an indulgence here. The city of Fort McMurray, the city itself in the regional municipality of Wood Buffalo, has decided 2010 that it would be the most sustainable northern community on the planet. Let me tell you one thing that they're doing that's quite amazing that people don't know about. They've taken over their landfill. Per capita, they're the largest creators of municipal solid waste on the planet. Don't be surprised, there's lots of construction, right? It's not that they're wasteful people, they're in this environment. They have taken over their landfill. They've got a low temperature gasification system going in that is sitting in a shipping container that they put 10 tons of municipal solid waste in a day. They generate out of that 750 kilowatts of electricity, enough for 200 homes off grid. They collect their metals and their glass out of that as well. There's four byproducts. They're doing that right now, and they will put it up to scale. They can do 750 because they don't need an environmental assessment to do that because it's small enough. But the town is very excited about this. And this can be transferred to any place, and they're experimenting. And it's low temperature, 450 degrees. The generator is reconditioned generators that are both ships in the middle of the boreal forest. The four things that come out of that after electricity are ash. We need that for concrete. We use that. CO2, which we capture. Methane, which we capture. And heat. You take those three ingredients, that's three quarters of a greenhouse. They are now, and have operating now, they add light into it in another shipping container on a year-round basis on an aquaponics greenhouse system are growing leafy vegetables. When Chiquita Bananas said, we're no longer going to use oil sands oil, we said, we'll grow our own bananas. Up there. That is being done. There's greenhouses now. And Synovus, I implore you, we can capture the CO2 out of in situ. We can't capture it out of pits. We should have greenhouses beside every one of those plants, and that should be feeding fresh, nutritious vegetables with a lower carbon footprint than transporting them to your camp workers and to the local community. So think about putting greenhouses and using those things. The idea is climate change adaptation is let's quit trying to engineer a way around it only. Let's try and engineer a way back into the carbon cycle and start doing it. Fort McMurray is doing that.
Well, I mean, just very briefly, I mean, this is going to be the big challenge probably of the century. And if you look at IPCC, I mean, this is not a science debate anymore. This is an arithmetic question about how do we get to that carbon budget. I mean, I think one is our tax policy in Canada and in every other country, you get the best tax break on oil and gas exploration, which is, you know, where the highest risk is. That's why those tax breaks are. We don't need to find any more reserves. We do not need any more activity on finding new reserves. If we pump out all the proven reserves that are existing now, that's enough. That's more than enough. So every single new activity related to some huge tax break with a subsidy to do a new offshore oil and gas exploration for some unproven new field should stop now. At least to begin with that, we can run out what we have. But we're facing, you know, just think about it. It's 60%, and that is from a global demographic. We have to go from about 700. You know, kilos CO2 equivalent per capita per year to about 100. That's the order of magnitude when you look at it at a global scale. So this is really absolutely unprecedented.
I'm just thinking about other developing renewable energy, other alternatives to getting energy or resources. When you look at Ontario, it's really about government policy pushing policy forward, such as renewable energy, and there has been issues in Ontario, and it's going downward right now because it's not attractive, and I don't think that's the best approach. But I would say that developing localized renewable energy could be beneficial in the sense that I was part of a community up in Ontario where they're the first 100% owned renewable energy resource wind tower project. And I was happy to be part of that, and they're making them using their own local energy. So I think those kind of projects that I can find tangible, that I can work with, those are wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Jessica.
I had a question about the relative responsibilities of companies versus government in consultation. So I know legally, as you explained, the government remains responsible and they can delegate consultation. I was wondering, I'd like both of your opinions on this, if you think that it's legitimate for the government to be delegating this responsibility, particularly the financial aspect of it. Is it problematic? And in cases where revenue-sharing policies are developed with First Nations, what are IBAs doing? Are they still accommodation? Are they some way of getting a social license to operate?
Who wants to start in on that? Catherine?
I find your question very complicated to answer. If I gather, so you're saying that if they're delegating the responsibility, is that legitimate? I would say yes and no, in the sense that they push, I know that industry expresses, like, it places a burden on industry to engage in consultation where there are deeply much more rooted issues that need to be dealt with that concern Aboriginal peoples. And that's where government it's not taking its fiduciary responsibility seriously. And another thing with these impact benefit agreements, that's what I mean about these IBAs there. That's the from a First Nations perspective, IBAs can almost take the form as a treaty because to them it's something so much greater than just a contract. It's a relationship with the company, but in reality, it's not there to resolve all their socioeconomic issues, and that's where government is disregarding its responsibility, and then industry is expected to resolve those economic social issues. So there's a barrier there, and that's why there needs to be more conversation on those issues.
Ken?
I think it's legitimate for industry to be in the situation of accommodation on a good neighbor policy basis. What am I going to do that's going to interfere? I want to build a fence. What kind of fence do I want to build? Well, you're going to be living on the other side of that fence. You should have some say in that, right? That's a very superficial example, and please don't consider it too trite, but it's that kind of attitude that, what am I doing that's going to impact my neighbors, and should I not talk to them about it, and should we not work this out together on a community basis? That's where I think industry and First Nations should be relating, and there's a mitigation, there's accommodation thing there, but it comes to health and education and treaty rights and everything that's in the treaties is not something that industry should be taking on. And when you pass this consultation responsibility onto industry, all those questions get avoided, because industry does not want to go and assume the responsibility for those obligations, and quite frankly, First Nations don't want them to assume those responsibility for those obligations either. That's where our government of Canada has to come in and start dealing with it. But until they do, the consultation process becomes a dollar negotiation and not a rights negotiation. Right?
A last word to Scott before we close our session.
So just on your question, I agree with what Catherine and Ken have said. The company consultation shouldn't replace in any way the formal legal duty to consult. And if you listen to Catherine, one of the key areas where that consultative process takes place is in environmental assessments. And one of the realities now is, with the changes that took place in Ottawa 2 years ago under C-38, one of the key triggers is the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. Under the old regime, there was about 6,000 environmental assessments that the federal government ran a year. Under the new regime, it's about 30. So the order of magnitude is that consultative process has now disappeared.
Well, on your behalf, let me thank our panelists for, I think, a constructive and at sometimes hopeful conversation. It now gives me a great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Will Straw, who is the director of this August Institute, and he will introduce our keynote speaker.